You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 26th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Rebecca Watson.
Hello.
Perry DeAngelis.
Good evening, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Good evening.
And just returning from a trip to Las Vegas, Evan Bernstein.
And boy, are my arms tired.
Oh,
that's a
that's
the
best
that's
you
how
could
we're
do.
Starting the show on
that's
a low note.
Okay.
I traveled 12 hours today. I was up at 6:30. I'm just getting now to my computer at home.
That's
so
no
cut
excuse.
Me a little bit of slack.
How was your trip to Sin City, Evan?
It was very, very good. It was productive.
Excellent, excellent.
Productive.
It was productive.
All right, did you gamble at all?
I did gamble.
What'd you play? What's your game?
Well, I played a little bit of craps and won $25. And then I stuck 50 cents in a slot machine and won $1,300. I hit a jackpot.
Is that
Are
true?
Serious?
Yep, it's absolutely true.
Wow. Oh, my God.
There I'm you skeptical. Go. That's
Congratulations.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Slot machines
Thank you.
Are great.
You know what's so funny? Bob, who was absent tonight, was on a cruise last week. And Bob won $1,000 playing blackjack.
Wow.
Sweet. Oh,
so I'm going to go gamble soon.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of skeptical sign in a favorable part of the heavens or something.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah, Bob is not with us tonight. He is at a physics conference that he will report to us on next week in the next episode.
Oh, I washed a pair of pants and I found a $20 bill balled up in the pocket when I took them
well,
out.
Well, we're all just that making money left and right. This is incredible.
Yes.
Believe.
I can't take this.
Now, I'm looking through the latest issue of the Skeptical Inquirer. A must-read, by the way, for any self-respecting
Fine
skeptic.
Fine publication.
Fine publication. And I see here on page 11 a picture that is captioned, Skeptical Youth at the Conference. And this is talking about James Randi's amazing meeting, which was in Las Vegas, I believe it was in January, including our very own Rebecca Watson.
Oh, my God, really? I actually didn't even know
you
that.
You didn't see that yet? There she is in all
no.
her glory.
Yay.
So you were one of the skeptical youth at the amazing meeting.
A skeptic? I don't think I'm a youth anymore, am I?
Oh, compared to skeptics out there.
That's
true.
I'm 25. I guess that's
Did you seem youthful at the meeting? Did you look around yourself?
I think I was rather youthful, yeah. That's true.
There you go.
Is it a good picture? Because I haven't seen it.
It's you and a few other guys. Dave Hawley, Matt Fiore, you know these guys?
Yeah, yeah. Wait, what are you suggesting? That I'm hanging out in Vegas with a bunch of guys and I don't even know who they are?
Well, there's the picture.
Uh-huh.
We have photographic evidence.
Thank you for besmirching my character on the podcast.
You're welcome. Anytime. Now, Rebecca, just a quick follow-up. On a previous podcast, I issued you a specific challenge to find a reference in the Old Testament to Mothra, although I did widen it a bit to allow you some leeway. It could be any Japanese monster movie monster, you know, Gamera,
right.
Mothra, whatever. Take your pick. This was spawned by the notion that some literalists, you know, creationists, interpret the Old Testament passages about behemoths and leviathans to mean that references to dinosaurs, even specific dinosaurs. And you said you could find a passage in that that you could twist into a reference for Mothra. So were you successful in your attempt?
I did even better. I found one in the New Testament, which is
okay.
Like, you know, so much better than the Old Testament because it's, you know, it's newer. But in Matthew, it's true. Matthew 6:19 says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy." Now, I know I don't have to explain this to you guys, but just to spell it out for our slower listeners, Japan represents the overabundance of wealth, the treasures on earth that are being stored up. The rust obviously represents the red-winged monster Rodan. And
okay.
Then, of course, there's the Mothra. QED.
Very
okay,
excellent.
Okay, not bad. Not bad.
Excellent.
And now, not bad. That's perfect. That's right
pretty
on.
Very good.
I don't know.
Now, speaking of Las Vegas, and which brings us to Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller have the wonderful show on Showtime called Bullshit, where they poke relentless fun at the most ridiculous stuff that they can come up with, which is not challenging. They have an upcoming episode where they are discussing cryptozoology.
Actually, I think it just aired.
Oh, did it just air?
I think it aired 2 days ago.
Well, on the website, they had a little preview of the show. Did you see the whole episode, Rebecca?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
So the preview shows footage of Bigfoot, footage which is known as the Sonoma Bigfoot because it's alleged to have been filmed in Sonoma, California. And this was filmed in November of 2005. And on their show, on the show Bullshit, Penn and Teller are admitting that they hoaxed the Bigfoot footage.
Yeah, it's really awesome because they released this footage back in November, and a lot of Bigfoot enthusiasts really grabbed a hold of it. Like the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, BFRO.
Yeah, they took the biggest hit.
Yeah, yeah, because they're like the big Bigfoot organization, I guess. And on their website, they grabbed a hold of this stuff, and they said things like, "We've seen hoax footage over the years, but there's no way that this could have been hoaxed. It's definitely not a man in a costume." Like, just open up your mouth wide and insert one Bigfoot.
open mouth, insert Bigfoot. they mentioned specifically about anatomical details, the length of the arms, the nature of the walk, a lot of the kind of things that's familiar with other Bigfoot video analysis.
Right.
And, of course, you know, they were proving basically that they cannot distinguish a hoax from what is real.
Exactly.
Although to be fair, I searched as extensively as I could on the Sonoma Bigfoot, and there are quite a number of Bigfoot sites that thought it was a hoax. So
right.
They
right.
didn't take in everybody. Right. Certainly, the ones who were taken in, that's a huge hit to their credibility, which I suppose is the whole point of the hoax to begin with.
Oh yeah, and if you watch the video, it's so obvious they didn't even try. It's so badly done.
I think they tried to do it so badly that would make it all the worse that somebody would believe it. But I think they might have gone a little bit too far. You know, I'm sure that they'll play up on their episode the ones who bought it hook, line, and sinker. But you know, it does backfire a little bit in that the pro Bigfoot sites that were critical of it can say, we knew that was a hoax, so, you know, that ups their street cred, basically.
Right.
So, you know, it kind of had mixed results, and I think if you're going to do something like that, and not that we haven't talked about it, that's kind of the fantasy of all skeptics, is to pull the big hoax, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it is very difficult. If you're going to do it, you have to make sure you fool everybody, you know. Mm. Otherwise, it does backfire on you. You also, the other potential downside to it is that you have to make sure you so carefully and fully document your hoaxing that nobody could claim afterwards that you're lying about having hoaxed it.
Which is exactly what they're doing right now.
Which some people are now still doing. They think it's still real. This all goes back to the first person to do this was James Randi.
Oh, yeah.
The Alpha, Project Alpha. You guys familiar with this?
Yes.
Yes.
Where Randi planted a couple of mentalists, magicians, in a psychic researcher's lab, and through sleight of hand, you know, bending spoons mostly, they completely had these guys going. I mean, they had them completely hoodwinked, as well as a large portion of the psychic research world, until Randi revealed the whole thing, you know, to be a trick. Those who bought into it, same story, you know, those who bought into it, their credibility was severely hurt, and there were even many, you know, research programs that were shut down because of that loss of credibility. So it had the intended effect, although it had other reverberations, for example, striking a wedge between, you know, the skeptical scientific community and the Psy research community. It significantly contributed to their isolation, you know, from the rest of the scientific world, which, you know, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Steve, do you remember when you had the Bigfoot program not too long ago and you interviewed someone?
From the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society, yeah.
Right. I remember you saying, I was listening to that episode not too long ago, and I remember you saying that in a lot of these, the footage that people see, there's that particular gray area where, you know, the quality of the film is at a certain level, the distance from the subject is at a certain level, and I noticed that in the Penn and Teller video that they really did do what you described in that video. They had the distance and the blurriness and the unsteadiness of the camera and
It was enough to be provocative, but not in sufficient detail to be definitive. You know?
And Steve, I just want to pop back to what you were saying before, really quickly, about how a lot of people are now saying that Penn and Teller are faking, that they were faking it, and how important it is to document how you're faking it. But I just have to say that so often, you know, it doesn't really matter. There will always be those true believers who are going to say, no, it's real. I've given people cold readings where I've told them afterward, that was a fake, and here's exactly how I did it. And they'll say, no, you really have psychic powers. You just don't know
it. You just don't know your own power.
Yeah.
That always happens.
Yeah.
But at least with, like, a video of a Bigfoot, you can have another camera taping the hoaxing. You know, you can have some concrete evidence to show the process of doing it.
They do end up showing the guy who played Bigfoot in the video, and they have him reading the emails that they got as a result of it on that episode of Bullshit. So, you know, they do show the suit and, you know, how they made it and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's entertaining. It's good. It's at the level of the show. I mean, I love their show. I think it's great. But they definitely err more on the side of entertainment.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They've never said that they're doing anything like science. They're just having fun.
We've also all seen how the crop circles are made, and that's obvious.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
That's very easy to document that hoax.
Right.
And that's been done. People have documented themselves hoaxing crop circles that were later pronounced genuine by the crop circle community.
And some of the most complex
things. You don't have to hide
a
camera or anything. You just tape doing it, and then you bring out the crop circle believers the next day, and they're all over it, and you show them the tape back. Here, we did it.
I believe you're referring to seriologists.
Seriologists.
Yeah, right.
That's what they call themselves.
As they like to refer to themselves.
That's right.
Scienticians.
In classic pseudoscientific fashion.
Oh, my God.
Seriologists.
Now, Evan, when you were in Las Vegas, did you see Penn and Teller?
I did, in fact, yes, at the Rio. They do a show every night, except Tuesdays. They're dark on Tuesdays. An excellent show. Outstanding. Two things of note. The first thing was, before the show, they invite everyone up on stage to inspect a wooden box that's on a set of caster wheels, and you can do whatever you want. You can touch it, you can move it. It's a box, and obviously, you know, a person would fit inside this box, and everyone went up there, inspected that box, and to start the show, the piano player says, okay, here they are, Penn and Teller. Penn comes walking out one side of the stage, goes over to the box, taps on it, and out pops Teller out of nowhere.
Cool.
It's just really incredible. It really got the show off to quite a bang, and everyone was just in stitches laughing, and everyone was nobody saw how Teller got in that box.
That's great.
So that was pretty. That was,
Evan,
that
was, is it possible that he was in there the whole time?
No, absolutely not. He snuck in somehow.
Do you think it was a miracle?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, you don't think it was some sort of trick?
It was just perfect, you know, deception.
Come on, Steve. Yeah, Occam's razor, a miracle, a trick. I think trick gets cut off first.
What was even more impressive,
it is the
though,
more complicated explanation.
The other thing I thought that was even more impressive is that they had a stack of five books, joke books. And according to Penn, these are just like the top five joke books off of Amazon.com. He hands them to a member of the audience, all right, tells the person, choose a book, all right, choose any one of those five, and then hand it to the person in back of you. And then that person hand it to back of them. And it works its way through about eight sets of hands somewhere to the back of the room. The person then opens the book anywhere. Penn doesn't know which book you're looking at. He opens the book. You choose a joke, and Penn is able to psychically, quote-unquote, come up with the punchline for the joke that you are thinking about. It's a wonderful cold reading trick that he does, and he did it to perfection. It was very, very impressive.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
How was the joke?
I don't recall. It was something about difference between a millionaire and a billionaire. I don't even remember what the punchline was.
But I don't know how they do it, but it probably wasn't cold reading. I mean, it was probably, you know, they were cheating. I mean, he had some way of knowing what it was, joke.
Well, he explained it in the context that this is in effect what the cold readers do, and he says they don't even do it half this good.
No, they don't.
Right? That he can do it. And if he's telling you that it's a trick, then everyone, you know, he wants to make sure everyone in that audience knows that psychics are absolute BS.
Right. I mean, the best cold readers are mentalists. The psychics who do cold reading, whether they know that's what they're doing or not, are not that good at it. Like, John Edwards really is not that good at cold reading.
Oh, he's terrible.
That's why he's not on
TV
anymore.
Horrible.
He is on TV. He's on Women's Entertainment, because that's what entertains women. Women's Entertainment.
Seriously, I didn't know that. I didn't know
swear
that.
To God.
Well, he's not on NBC
a woman, I'd be
anymore,
insulted.
You know? Oh, yeah,
Steve,
and
plenty
of women
are. Do you think
John Edwards
is a faker, or do you think he's a self-deceiver?
He's a faker. He's a fraud.
He's a faker.
I know, yeah, you, I know you weren't that's asking me, but that's just fact. He's a fraud.
He's also the biggest douche in the universe.
He is.
I was trying to think of a way to say it a little bit more diplomatically, but the bottom line is, though, when you can see him using cold reading techniques consciously, statistically, he's got to be deliberately faking it.
Of course.
You know what I mean? You can't be deceiving yourself when you're using conscious, deceptive techniques.
He's a con artist. That's the official stance of the New England Skeptical Society.
Right. In our opinion, he's a con artist.
You told us off air that you spoke to them briefly, Evan?
Yeah. Well, what they do is after the show, they go out into the lobby and you can have your picture taken with them. They'll sign autographs and they'll talk to you for a little while. So I did get a chance to speak with both of them. And, although nothing official, and I did invite them onto our show so that we could interview either of them or both of them. And they said that they would seriously consider it.
Their people will talk to our people?
Exactly. I did speak with one of their PR people as well. They all have our business card, and I'm hoping to hear from them in the near future so that we can make an arrangement.
Well, I would love to have them
on this
show,
podcast for you.
Can I also can I just mention that the bullet catch that they perform, that was designed by Banachek, who is another really amazing magician that people should check out if you've never heard of him. He's great.
I didn't know that.
Mentalist, and yeah, he's amazing.
Let's go on to our next news item this week. TV Seance claims to have reached John Lennon. So, in a brazen attempt to exploit the memory of John Lennon, a pay TV service, In Demand, aired, I believe, on Monday. I didn't pay the $10 to see it.
Oh.
aired a live seance in which they purport to speak to the ghost of John Lennon.
Did he sing? I
don't suppose any of you caught this.
No,
I didn't.
They had on their EVP, which stands for Electronic Voice Phenomenon Specialist, Sandra Bellinger, to examine the voice, and she proclaims it's the real deal. That's very consistent with a Class A EVP. That's good pseudoscientific jargon there.
Yeah.
She said, regarding the level and clarity of the voice, she also says the voice sounds like how Lennon would have talked.
If
he were dead, I guess. What a surprise.
And who's going to disagree with her, seriously?
Steve, were they like listening to her like, is that you, John Lennon? Yes, it's me. Are you kidding me?
Oh, it's so silly.
It's lame. These are the same people a couple of years ago in 2003 that attempted to contact Princess Diana through channeling.
Did that one work?
No. So they're making a career.
That's called English channeling.
So what did John Lennon have to say?
You know, they're not, because they don't want to discourage people from paying the $10, they were not, you know, releasing any specifically what he said during the alleged seance.
Did they mention if they inform Yoko Ono of this?
Yoko Ono, to her credit, declined to comment.
Good.
And their long-term spokesman said that this was an exercise in tacky, exploitative, and far removed from the icon's way of life. So,
thank you.
Lennon's people were pretty condemning of the whole affair.
I can't help but think, like, let's just go under this. Let's suppose together that, okay, this really does exist, right? What's going on the other side? Like, if you're the ghost of John Lennon, you know, we'd hope that he's in heaven, right? You know, if ghosts exist, and let's say heaven exists.
Well, just imagine there's no heaven.
Like, is he straining on the other side to communicate? Like, was he hearing them in the same ridiculous manner that we're hearing him? Is it as blurry and fuzzy to him? And, you know, is he waving his arms? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I always thought they were playing charades. You know?
Yeah.
I see an M. Is it an M?
Yeah.
I imagine mostly what he does is think up ways to haunt David Chapman, I imagine, is what he probably spends most of his time doing. I'm guessing here.
We do have a large number of emails, which keep coming in, and which is great. We appreciate all the emails that you send us. I'm going to read a select few. I'm going to start with actually three emails, all of which provide either some small correction or addition to one of our recent podcasts. Now, one of the great things about doing a show like this, and as our community of listeners is growing, there's always somebody out there who knows probably more about a specific topic than we do, especially when we stray from the things that we've really researched and we're talking a little bit more off the cuff. There's always one layer more of detail or accuracy or precision that you can get to. So, and it's great to get that level of clarity and detail into our show. So definitely send us those corrections and additions. However, we are definitely getting to the point where we can't read them all on air. We are working, you know, especially, you know, Jay, our webmaster, is working on developing our bulletin board, and either through that or something similar, we're going to provide a location on our website where listeners can not only discuss our shows, they can also add their links and references and maybe make some additions or corrections as necessary. And we'll talk about the ones that are especially, you know, important or interesting on air. But I'm gonna mention a few that we did get over the last couple of weeks. The first one is about the global warming and hurricanes. This email is from Keith, who says, "Hi, guys. In your latest podcast, you were discussing the impact of global warming on hurricanes. Stephen Perry stated that statistically we would have more storms, hurricanes, with global warming. I think the current research says that we would have more intense hurricanes, but we have no evidence of more frequent hurricanes." And then he gives a reference, which we have on our website. It says, "I know this is a minor point, but you guys always seem concerned with being accurate, which I appreciate. Avid fan, Keith." Again, thanks, Keith, for writing us in. I did check this out, and I tried to do as much background research as I can. The key reference is on pewclimate.org, and that's basically correct. The current evidence shows that increasing ocean temperatures, whether you think it's due to man-made global warming or not, definitely increases the intensity of hurricanes. However, so far, there's no evidence that it increases the number of hurricanes. The number of hurricanes recently has, in fact, been increasing, but it fits into the pattern of, you know, waxing and waning number of hurricanes over the last 100 years. So, again, we get to that same sort of controversy of, is the recent increase a trend or just part of the normal oscillation? Again, it doesn't really change the essence of what we were talking about, but that it does. It's a good example of how there's always that extra layer of detail to get to. The second correction comes from Mike Chartier, who writes, "I would like to correct your birthday problem posed in the first part of the latest show. First off, the problem should be stated ending with at least 50 and not a 50-50, as you stated. The correct answer to the problem is 23, not 20. Basically, this is the birthday problem, where, again, this is sort of an off-the-cuff comment. How many people would you have in the same room in order to have a greater than 50% chance that two of them have the same birthday? And I recalled that as being 20. Although, Evan, you say that you said 23.
Yeah, and I did. And you know what, Steve? I do have it on tape. I happened to record that lecture we did years and years ago,
right,
at Southern Connecticut State University, and at that lecture we presented the number being 23.
Yeah, I mean, I had stated off of memory as 20, but yeah, 23 is the accurate number. That's when it gets a little bit over 50%. The third correction, this is actually more of an addition. This one comes from Roy Peterson in the UK. Roy writes, "I have just downloaded your latest podcast, which was recommended via the Skepticality forum." It's interesting. "I was flabbergasted that your recommendations..."
I think that was me, actually.
Oh, thank you.
We have a mole.
I was pretty upfront about it.
Well, good work. "I was flabbergasted that your recommendations to a listener's voice request for more information on evolution did not include one of Richard Dawkins' books. What about The Selfish Gene or The Blind Watchmaker? These are classic publications on the subject. You naughty people." And he sent that with a little frowny face.
I love it when our listeners call us naughty.
Sometimes we are very naughty. Well, Roy, I definitely appreciate your recommendations. We'll add them to our list on that notes page. The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker are absolute classics in evolutionary writing. And this was not deliberate on my part. It just happened to be the books I had on my shelf that I was looking at. The Richard Dawkins and really is at one end of the spectrum in terms of some controversies of modern evolutionary thinking, and Gould and Eldridge are at the other end of the spectrum. So the two books, The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker, are important not just for completeness but also to provide good, you know, balance to, you know, Gould's take on modern evolutionary theory. Which is a very interesting topic. You know, we don't really have time to get into it completely here. It has a lot to do with the inherent progressiveness of evolution and can you understand evolutionary theory at the gene level, or do you really have to look at it at multiple levels, you know, gene versus species versus populations and even ecosystems? Very, very interesting details about, you know, the way evolution progresses and the way natural selection works and operates. So I accept those additions to our recommended evolutionary reading. The next email is about logical fallacies. This one comes from Mark Smith in Lansing, Kansas. He says, my only suggestion... I'm sorry, he starts out writing about Dianetics and basically just telling us how ridiculous it is. He says, I'm still laughing years later at how ludicrous Dianetics is. And then he goes into a question. He says, my only suggestion for the show would be to put more of an emphasis on logical fallacies, like the ones listed on your webpage. Logic geek that I am, I find these very entertaining, and they're also useful everyday tools, especially in a popular culture where fallacious thinking runs rampant. But they're not always self-evident, even when they have been pointed out and identified. As a result, I think the nature of fallacy is too often ignored. For instance, I happen to have on my desk a booklet called The Miniature Guide to Critical Thinking Concepts and Tools from the Foundation for Critical Thinking. And amazingly, I can find no mention of logical fallacies anywhere in it. One idea for the show would be to spotlight a fallacy and explain it using current examples from popular media or the news. The examples wouldn't need to be from scientifically oriented stories exclusively, as long as they include an attempt to support a certain position using a logical fallacy. I have a feeling that examples would be trivially easy to find. Thanks for the great podcast. In a perfect world, you guys would be paid like pro basketball players, and Rebecca would be on the cover of every magazine. Keep up the fight, and keep living the sweet dream of reason. Woohoo! Well, Mark, thanks for the kudos.
That's definitely the best letter. Yeah.
That was the best ending to an email that we've had recently. That's not the first person to suggest that we should be making lots of cash doing what we're doing. I have the feeling that we're missing something. Maybe we're not as smart as we think we are.
Yeah, if there's a promoter out there who wants to work with us, I'm sure we'd be open to speaking with them.
I'd be willing to shoot a few hoops.
Well, Mark, we like your idea about showcasing logical fallacies. We have bandied that idea about in the past, and I do think it is time that we add a logical fallacy segment. So we're going to try out a couple of formats before we solidify something, and at which point we might have even some intro music. But we're going to do a brief logical fallacy segment on this show. Now, by coincidence, unless you are the kind of person who doesn't believe in coincidences,
at which point go away.
We had another email this week. This one comes from Cecil in Chicago, Illinois, and Cecil writes, here is a short clip of Kirk Cameron visiting with a guy who tries to prove the existence of God by exhibiting the amazing design of the banana. I checked the top 20, and I am not skilled enough to recognize the logical fallacy. Can you help? Well, this is a perfect opportunity to play our new game, which is Name That Logical Fallacy. But first, Rebecca, you specifically asked if you could give a synopsis of the banana argument.
Yeah.
So what is the God of the bananas is what I'm calling it. So give us the synopsis.
I love this clip. For those of you who don't know, it's got Kirk Cameron of Growing Pains fame and some Australian dude sitting by a lake talking about how silly atheists are. And at this particular part, he says, the Australian guy says, behold the atheist nightmare, and he pulls out a banana. And
I recoiled when I saw it.
We all did a little. The banana, you know, it's a banana. It's about 7 inches long, inch and a half thick or so. You know, your average banana. And he says, now, if you have a well-made banana, you'll find on the far side there are 3 ridges, and on the near side, 2 ridges. Ridges apparently being very important. And then he goes on to compare that shape with the shape of a human hand when holding the banana and saying that they're a perfect fit. He says the banana and the hand are perfectly made one for the other, at which point he slips the banana suggestively into his hand. He says, you'll notice that the maker of the banana, or mighty God, has made it with a non-slip surface. Another very important trait, apparently. He then goes on to say, God has placed a tab at the top. When you pull the tab, the contents don't squirt in your face. I'm not making this up. That's word for word.
We have the link for the video clip. It is.
He actually says when you pull the tab, the contents don't squirt in your face, which is true so long as you aim it away from you.
Even if you shake the banana, they
you can do whatever you want to the banana. It will never squirt you in the face.
And I've tried.
And then my favorite quote. He says, the wrapper has perforations. Notice how gracefully it sits over the human hand. Notice it has a point at the top for ease of entry. Just the right shape for the human mouth. And it's even curved toward the face to make the whole process easier.
Oh, wait a minute.
Now, just to remind everybody, we're talking about a banana.
This is a joke video, right?
No,
this guy is dead serious.
Dead serious, and he seems to believe that he's still talking about a banana by the end of that. Oh, read from that what you will.
God. Well, you know, as Freud said, sometimes a banana is just a banana. But let's talk about the logical fallacies inherent in this argument. They are subtle, and I immediately teased out three logical fallacies. We'll see, maybe we could find more. But I think the core logical fallacy is a tautology, mainly that the argument is because the banana is convenient for humans to eat, that it was therefore that convenience is what caused the banana to be the way it is. In other words, it was therefore specifically designed to be convenient for humans to eat, or the effect causing the cause. That's the core logical fallacy. But you have to couple the tautology with an unstated major premise behind the entire argument, which is that design implies God. That because the banana is designed to be convenient for eating, that God is the only thing that could have done that. And he is dismissing, without specifically saying so, hence an unstated major premise, that evolution could not have resulted in a fruit that has features that make it convenient for human consumption. In fact, fruit evolved to be convenient for animal consumption. That's the purpose, evolutionary purpose of fruit.
And not only that, Steve,
will eat it.
But haven't humans genetically modified bananas to be...
Yeah, isn't this a case of artificial...
In addition, there has been some. I don't think it's been genetically modified. It was just through breeding. A lot of the crops that we use have been modified through human tinkering. So to be even more useful, for human consumption than nature made it.
Right. Rebecca, did this guy think he was conducting science?
I think he did. Well, they seem to think that this is like logical. They seem to believe that this is the death knell for atheism.
I know it's not appropriate in our constant search for and endeavor at erudition on this program, but can't we simply say that this is asinine? I mean, is it appropriate in this case? It beggars
the
imagination.
Then we can't have fun. Then we can't have fun dissecting his fallacies. And I really like dissecting his fallacies and saying that when we're talking about the bananas. And
yes, that is certainly more appropriate in this case.
The guy is a total pervert. He's a pervert. I like the way the banana feels in my mouth.
Sometimes things are so absurd.
Sometimes our initial reaction is that this is asinine.
The initial reaction that it's asinine or absurd is appropriate and accurate. But... the part of doing this show is to go beyond that. Let's take it the next step.
Yes,
and let's take great pains to explain exactly why it's absurd. The reason is that when you have these really extreme examples of logical fallacies, they make good examples, to teach you how to avoid more subtle logical fallacies in claims that are not initially obviously absurd.
But what about all of the fruits that exist that aren't easy to eat?
Now, Jay, that brings up the third logical fallacy that I teased from this, which is the fallacy of inconsistency. If you're going to say that the convenience, the easy digestibility of the banana is evidence of a benign creator, then you have to argue that everything in nature which is inconvenient and harmful is contradictory evidence, or evidence against a benign creator.
Well, it's evidence of Satan.
The lobster is evidence that God hates us.
The lobster, or, you know, have you ever tried to eat a pomegranate?
Not going to choke me, yeah.
Or an artichoke? Only it might have choked Artie. It ain't going to choke
me. I ate six seeds of a pomegranate once.
But guys, don't miss the whole point of name that logical fallacy. Now, maybe in the future I might have to challenge you guys to see if you can come up with a logical fallacy. So.
Yeah, I like this idea. I enjoy this.
It is fun. It is fun. Well, we have an interview this week, an interview with Brian Trent, and let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Brian Trent. Brian, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thank you for having me.
Brian is the author of the award-winning historical novel Remembering Hypatia, which is about the final collapse of enlightenment of the ancient world. He's also the author of numerous books and articles on topics as diverse as future immortality and the effect of modern technology on privacy and freedom. So, Brian, why don't we start by you telling us, just give us a synopsis of Remembering Hypatia and just, you know, thematically, what is this book about?
Certainly. Well, it's the story takes place in the final days of not only the Great Library of Alexandria, one of the greatest repositories of learning in the ancient world, but also the last, 23 days of the life of Hypatia, who was the last curator of that library. She was a mathematician, an astronomer, a philosopher, and a teacher at a time when women were pretty much shunned from learning to begin with. And she pretty much achieved the Renaissance man ideal about 1,000 years before it was fashionable. She was one of the most brilliant people in history. She was murdered on the eve of the Dark Ages by a man who was later proclaimed to be a saint. Her death, her assassination, is one of the pivotal events. It pretty much closes off that era of history, the classical age of history, and we have then the medievalism that characterized the Dark Ages.
Now, do you think that her death was just a milestone marking an inevitable transition, or do you think that her death actually contributed to or hastened the Dark Ages?
Well, she lived at a time when there was an upswing of religious fundamentalism. And again, this is not about religious freedom. I mean, Alexandria that she lived was a place that had rampant religious freedom. Earl Robinson described America one time and said, all races and religions, that's America to me. Well, that same sentiment applies to Alexandria. I mean, they had, it was a pluralistic community, it was a multicultural community, and there were, even with Christianity itself, there were different sects of Christianity which would, debate with each other and philosophize about the nature of divinity and the Trinity and so forth. And well, there was a hardline faction which was taking control of the city by force, mostly through the force of personality of Archbishop Cyril, the guy who would later have her murdered. And she stood against him very strongly, very publicly. And her death, I think her death was that knockout blow of that title fight. It showed people that if you stand up against this guy, you're going to get murdered because nothing was done about it. And really no secular authority ever challenged that theocratic regime again.
So it had, her death had a chilling effect on anyone else who would stand against the authority of the archbishop.
That's fair to say. And you have the next 1,000 years were characterized by that very hardline fundamentalist element, at least until the first glimmers of the Italian Renaissance. So it was, we see a shift into an era of witch burnings and crusades, and where knowledge was limited. First of all, the knowledge that disagreed with the prevailing theological notion of the universe was destroyed for the most part, and other times it was just buried or sometimes literally painted in between. Some monks in monasteries would fold papers of Archimedes in half and put new papers over it to make it nice and sturdy for their illuminated manuscripts, and that's the kind of era that that we saw for the next 1,000 years.
What year was her murder, Brian?
It was in the 5th century, around 414 or 415 A.D.
And how long was the library in existence?
The library had been formed probably around 9 years after Alexander the Great's death, when he created the city of Alexandria, quite literally, drew it in the dirt. And it was after he died, it was built probably about 9 years later. So we're talking about a 700-year-old learning institution.
And because Alexandria was such a well-traveled city and so cosmopolitan, you know, pretty much every ship that came through its port, its manuscripts and whatever books it may have happened to have on board were copied and stored in the Library of Alexandria. So it was an absolutely incredible repository of ancient, you know, writings and literature and knowledge. I mean, what a loss to history the destruction of that library was.
Do we have an idea of what some of those books might have been? Like, how advanced were their mathematics and their cosmology and things of that nature?
Well, certainly. We have some tantalizing glimpses. We have, for example, most school children today are taught that it was Columbus and Magellan who pretty much determined that the world was round and this and that. But Eratosthenes, 2,000 years ago, had, through mathematics alone, had figured out the shape and size of the Earth. You know, he had measured the discrepancy of two shadows on June 21st and had the distance paced out, plugged into an equation, came up with, his answer was about 1% off. We have people like Heron of Alexandria who had developed the concepts. I mean, although, you know, admittedly very primitive, but the concepts for steam engines. You have Archimedes, of course, one of the most unparalleled geniuses in all of human history, who had come up with a fantastic war machine for use against the Romans. And he had, of course, and he's the one credited with any number of inventions. I mean, the screw that bears his name, his famous concept of the lever. And it was the other thing, too, is the library was a dynamic place. You had Galen. There's another great, one of my favorites. Galen was a medical mastermind. He was so advanced with his medical techniques, his surgical techniques. He wrote a 15-book set on the human body, anatomy and physiology. And, I mean, I've seen side-by-side comparison to some of his surgical tools with the tools we have today in modern surgery wards. And, of course, the materials are completely different. But the concepts, most of the time, the equipment itself is virtually identical.
And a lot of his anatomy is still relevant today as well. You know, he figured out a lot of the basics of anatomy.
But he still believed in the humeral theory, though, right?
There were still the four humors, and some of those concepts were prevalent in Alexandria. But I mean, here's Galen certainly understood about the circulatory system. The blood didn't just swish around in the body. That I liken it to one of my favorite writers in history is Lord Byron. Now he contracted a fever, and of course the prevailing idea at that point was to bleed the guy, and of course he died. I like to think about not just his death, but I mean all the deaths that. If people had, on Galen's knowledge, if people had, you know, built on things that he knew, if that work hadn't been destroyed, it hadn't been lost, you know, just think of what we could accomplish. Even if you use conservative estimates, all that material had to be rediscovered.
It wasn't entirely lost. A lot of that knowledge actually was harbored in the Mideast, in Persia,
when the Arabs came in.
Yeah, I mean, the Dark Ages was very much a European Dark Ages. And meanwhile, mathematics and engineering and medicine and astronomy was thriving in the Middle East, in Persia.
That's right. Well, when they had conquered Alexandria in 646, a lot of those manuscripts, there were two things that happened, and I think it shows the two sides of human nature in a lot of ways. The invading, Muslim armies, they destroyed a lot of the remaining literature that was they considered to be infidel. I mean, the Christians had destroyed the pagan literature, and of course the Muslims destroyed a lot of the Christian literature. But as you said, not everything was lost, and that's how we know a lot about this place and a lot of the references, and a lot of the fragments of books and findings that we do know about. And it certainly did encourage them to come up with pioneering advances in mathematics. At the same time, you had a fundamentalist element which reared its head among their that religion as well. One of the last great ancient cities that had copies of Alexandria's books, and not all of them, but a lot of the findings, was Constantinople. And when Constantinople was being assailed by Muhammad II, a lot of these scholars managed to escape with some of the books, and a lot of them settled in Europe, specifically in Florence, which is the seat of the Renaissance later. But the books that were left behind were all destroyed.
Right.
So certainly, certain books were preserved, and I'm, you know, great era thinkers and so forth were able to build on that, certainly, and it absolutely contributed to their golden age, which, as you mentioned, Europe was in the middle of a dark age when the Middle East was quite advanced. Now, today, in the modern times, we see the opposite.
Right, that's right. In fact, you can actually trace back some of the seeds of knowledge that led to the Renaissance back through Persia and then into the ancient knowledge of, you know, the Greeks and Romans and back to the Library of Alexandria. So there is some continuity there. But again, there was a the 1,000-1,500 years of philosophical scientific dark ages. Interestingly, what I learned from studying that time is that technology still continued to progress fairly steadily in Europe throughout the Dark Ages, but it was more a Dark Ages of ideas, of inquiry, as it were.
Well, what was the core? How would you characterize, Brian, the core feud between Archbishop Cyril and Hypatia?
Well, one of Hypatia's few surviving quotes was, "All formal dogmatic religions are fallacious and should never be accepted by self-respecting persons as final." This is one of the few things, and this did not sit very well with him at all. This is a person who, Cyril, before he got to her, this is just not a nice man by any standards at all. He had a grudge against the Jews, just the fact, you know, all the different problems he had with them, and he had them driven from Alexandria. That's directly laid at his feet. He also, this is particularly interesting, when you talk about, you know, debate and, you know, coming to certain ideas and discussions, there were different sects of Christianity, like the Novatians and the Nestorians, and all these different people had different slices of opinion on that religion or on God or on the uncaused cause, the prime mover, things like that. These debates used to thrive in Alexandria, even among, you know, Christianity. He put a stop to that, him and his uncle, the Archbishop Theophilus. And his uncle had some sects exiled from the city on penalty of death.
Well, the church at the time was building its power based upon authority. You know, the idea
right.
was that knowledge descended from authority. And right. open-ended inquiry was completely incompatible with that. So that was the essence of the conflict, I think, was, you know, religious authority versus open-ended inquiry, and we know who won, right? And that was the Dark Ages, right?
To put it, I mean, talk about an arena of this, I mean, a more ironic arena. Hypatia was, according to the historical record, dragged from her chariot, pulled into a church, and murdered right there.
Her skin was flayed with abalone shells, is how Carl Sagan...
Shells, pottery shards, supposedly that in reed baskets, they emptied it out at their feet. It was passed out among all the parishioners. In my book, I say it's passed out like some unholy Eucharist. And they all, in their hands, they all just go at her and literally hack her and flay her to death.
Excuse me, Brian. Alexandria wasn't a theocracy, right? The church wasn't in charge of the political state.
391 AD, the Edict of Theodosius, prior to 391, we need to actually go back to Constantine in 311. Emperor Constantine, of course, he was the victor in an empire-wide civil war, and he chalked his victory up, as many leaders throughout history way before him, divine endorsement. Zeus gave, the Greeks the idea to take Troy the way they did, or Ahura Mazda, all these different deities throughout history. Well, Constantine chalked his victory up to a little-known deity at that time, which is Jehovah, and of course he is the one who created a state-endorsed religion. Christianity became the religion of the empire, but he still did allow religious freedom. He allowed other faiths to be tolerated. In 391, the Edict of Theodosius, that took the next logical, or as I like to say, evangelological step, which was, if we're tolerating, if we endorse one religion, what are we doing tolerating these other ones? So other faiths were outlawed throughout the empire, and pagan temples were destroyed, pagan priests were, pagan parishioners were converted at sword point, pagan priests and priestesses were killed, often crucified, despite the irony.
And at that point, that was 391, but that wasn't like the first major blow to the library, right? That was happening.
That was when the Serapeum was actually it was a temple devoted to the god Serapis, who was pretty much. You know, I think Alexander was unique. When the Greeks came into Egypt, they fused. I mean, you had this beautiful cross pollination of two very high civilizations. I mean, Egypt and Greece,
right.
And they were fused not just in architecture, but in a lot of ideologies and a lot of art. And Serapis, the Temple of Serapis, and its all the documents that it had, was a concrete symbol of that. So it was a very clear target in 391. But the library itself did persist, because we know, for the most basic reasons, we know that Hypatia was working there, that she was returning from the library at the time of her murder, and then it vanishes from history. Right as the upswing, the fundamentalists, and again we see parallels of that today. Look in the Middle East. Look at how political cartoons are treated. You know, now the Great Library has been resurrected in our modern age. The Bibliotheca Alexandrina was created in Egypt, and it houses something like 4 million books, and it has these 10 billion web pages archived, and it's supposedly a really extraordinary building. But my question is, and I applaud it, there's no question about that, but are they going to be eager to stockpile certain, say, political cartoons, or, say, the Satanic Verses by Rusty, or books like that? And if so, I mean, does anybody really doubt that a certain faction would want to see that heathen institution or that sacrilegious institution burned to a crisp again?
I think we need to look at it also as more of kind of a more insidious thing, because I think that often when we think of, say, the Great Library burning, we think of one big event when, you know, there was so much going on and so much building up to it. I don't know if you know about Matthew Battles, the writer and Harvard librarian, but he wrote a really interesting study about the library where he suggests that it wasn't just one great fire. He said it was moldering slowly through the centuries as people grew indifferent and even hostile to their contents. So I think we need to always be on the lookout for that same kind of insidious undercurrent of hostility towards knowledge that could spring up, you know, at any moment, while it could have been there all the time, you know. If that makes
sense. Well, I think it's always worth it. I definitely agree. That Aristotelian inquiry that is really the Socratic method, the basis for the scientific method, these things are just, and will always be, I think, a direct threat to certain kinds of people, certain people who have a certain ideology, a certain way of looking at the world. And it's something that we have to conscious. I think it's something we always have to fight. We have to step into that arena and stand up for it.
So, Brian, I find it interesting to think, is it even remotely possible that any kind of intellectual dark age could happen again? And during your research, what kind of conclusion would you draw from that?
No, I think it is a possibility. I think it's a terrible mistake for anyone to say it can't happen here, it can't happen again. And I think we have other concerns at this point. You know, first of all, there are still book burnings that happen. And we don't just have to point to the Middle East. I mean, in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, they were rounding up Harry Potter books and you know, rock and roll CDs and having this huge bonfire throwing. It was a church-sponsored event. So, I mean, we have it right here in this country. We don't need to go to foreign fronts to see that. Secondly, there's a different kind. I mean, we live in a world of mass production of where, you know, literature is available so fast and at the speed of light. You know, 186,000, 282 miles per second, you can get anything you want, you know, in all this information. But at the same time, because of the digital nature of a lot of this knowledge, it could be kind of akin to, if anybody read Animal Farm by George Orwell, the animals had that list of commandments that they were all going to abide by. And slowly over time, that list would insidiously get shorter, but not so shortly that they wouldn't actually notice it. Like it wasn't something sudden, it wasn't something dramatic. But by the end of the story, when they do realize, it's already too late. Everything has changed. A lot of knowledge has been lost. A lot of the original decree of this new society has been completely mutated and perverted. So I think that's something we have to worry about. I mean, you have they take a digital razor to films and to books and. People with, you know, any kind of access, political access to grind or any religious access to grind, I think it's important. A lot of this knowledge does pass through a limited number of hubs, and it is a rapidly diminishing media, if you think about it. So there are certain concerns.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so this is always an interesting question, and this is something that often gets asked of us. You know, in this modern age, do you really think that there can be another Dark Ages? And I sort of think about it in two different ways. On the one hand, you know, we are living in an increasingly worldwide culture with the internet, with, you know, incredible access to an ability to reproduce information. So it's certainly, from that point of view, would be much more difficult for any institution or nation or power to really completely put the clamp on information and inquiry in the way that was feasible and possible a couple of thousand years ago. But on the other hand, you know, we definitely see the effects of similar things occurring in pockets in individual nations or in individual cultures. For example, in the Soviet Union. There was the famous incident of Lysenkoism, where the Communist Party decided that this guy Lysenko, that his ideas about genetics and evolution, which were Lamarckian and incorrect, that was the official state-sponsored, you know, genetical theory. And the Russia is still now 30 years behind the rest of the industrialized world in genetics. They never caught up. It permanently set them behind. In this country, public understanding of evolution, and in fact, you know, the number of, you know, world-class top researchers in evolution in this country is much behind, you know, many other, you know, Western industrialized nations, and we're certainly lag behind that area than we do in many other areas, largely due to the systematic campaign of fundamentalists and creationists against the teaching of evolution. So these kind of insidious anti-intellectual, anti-inquiry movements can have far-ranging cultural implications. But my hope is that we have crossed some point where we have enough of a worldwide culture that it would be impossible to do it to the thoroughness and extent of what happened in the Dark Ages, but you know,
China has their own their own version of the internet.
That's right.
You know, somehow they're able to limit access on a national level.
Every June 3rd, I think it's June 3rd and 4th, the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, they black out that media that you're talking about. If any mention of that horrible event where all those thousands of protesters were destroyed. So yeah, I completely understand and agree.
That's until that regime falls, though. I mean, my personal view is that the regime in China is doomed to failure. Communism has been proven, a failure. It's on the ash heap of history. China just hasn't caught up.
Yeah,
yet.
It's interesting to see which way China will go. I mean, that's the last great experiment in pretty much exactly what we're talking about. Certainly since the 1970s, since Nixon, you know, and detente with China, the big experiment has been, will exposure, even just through marketing, you know, through commercial exposure to the West, erode China's iron grip on, you know, knowledge and information in their own country. I think we're still waiting to see how that's going to play out. But certainly the optimists are saying that, you know, China will either evolve away from totalitarianism and communism, and others think that at some point the regime may just collapse like the Soviet Union did. We'll see. That's a sort of a very relevant sort of social experiment that's occurring right now.
China just inducted private entrepreneurs into their Communist Party a few years ago. So I think I tend to be a little optimistic about that. On the other hand, there's just a concern about any kind of one. Communism isn't the only form of totalitarianism. I mean, you can have, you know, plutocracies. You can have anything at all. But I definitely think that I think it is destined to fall. I think the creaking is being heard.
And now, of course, we talked about how the Middle East was the repository of ancient knowledge during the European Dark Ages, and now the roles have very much reversed. I think it does remain to be seen how the Middle East is going to go in the near future. That part of the world seems to be largely under the grip of very extreme, you know, radical fundamentalist notions, which are extremely anti-knowledge, anti-intellectual. And that could create an intellectual dark ages in that part of the world that could last for a very long time.
Well, the thing is, too, there was a crossroads in that culture. In which, you know, they had more of the moderate element and the hardline element. And unfortunately, a lot of it, the hardline element, was almost elected or appointed as a result of the constant crusading parties from Europe all the time. So I think, you know, certainly, a lot of those holy wars had a lot to do with the evolution of the Middle East to what it is now. And I think that's a good point in the sense that, technologically speaking, people hear Dark Ages, we're not going to go back to throwing spears and catapults and stuff. I mean, we're looking at an ideological Dark Age where you can, and I think it's absolutely possible today.
Yeah, and that's, of course, one of the reasons why organizations like us, the New England Skeptical Society, exist. Because, you know, I think at some point there has to just be a fundamental support for open-ended and free inquiry, you know, without any oppressive restrictions, that has a certain intrinsic, inherent value to human civilization. But it is constantly being nibbled away at. It really is. And it takes a certain amount of vigilance to continually promote it and to keep the forces of anti-intellectualism at bay.
Unfortunately, anti-intellectualism is embedded in, I think, a lot of our traditions here in America, even the literary tradition. I mean, who was the villain in a lot of Nathaniel Hawthorne's work? One of the great American writers. It was always the intellectual, Roger Chillingworth from The Scarlet Letter, the Dr. Rappaccini, who created A Daughter of Pure Poison, the scientist from The Birthmark, who, in trying to seek perfection, ended up killing the woman he loves. I mean, these, and Bagwell and Poe, not that science is a prying vulture.
And Hollywood has picked up on those themes. I mean, Hollywood really knows very few themes when it comes to science. They know about the mad scientist, the arrogant scientist, and that's about it. They don't really have any positive.
Don't forget the foolish skeptic.
Right. The misguided, narrow-minded, closed-minded skeptic.
There's never going to be an asteroid that'll destroy the planet.
And or skeptics in a mystical world is also
right.
a very common theme that comes
right.
out of
which
Hollywood.
Of course rigs the game against the skeptics from the get-go. You know, if you're a skeptic in a paranormal world,
right.
that's a lose proposition for the skeptic. It's definitely possible to create short-term, and by short-term, that could mean decades or even centuries, significant setbacks in the advancement of knowledge and science because of, narrow political or social or religious ideology. I think in the long run, it all works itself out. But, again, we say the long run, that could be after 1,000 years of dark ages, right? And we can only speculate where we would be now as a civilization if that did not occur.
Which is why I think Hypatia's story is not only important, I think it's very, very relevant, and it's part of what attracted to me to this story. This is the last time you had a very serious, that title fight between rational thought, between pluralistic freedom, and then you have, between that blind superstition and blind faith. And we know who won, and then history, we've all been suffering for it since then.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that's really that's the relevance of the story to me. No one really choose willingly, knowing what they're talking about, really to choose to live in those 1,000 years of medievalism. And, people didn't travel more than 10 miles from where they lived. They were cut off from the world. They had there really was no education. There was, people didn't bathe more than once a month, because they were afraid. All the concepts of cleanliness and so forth and opening up one's mind were shattered and were buried, held under a thumb until you had it slowly eking out during later eras.
Imagine being an intellectual living during that time and how painful it must have been, being completely surrounded.
That's where the fires got you.
Yeah. Right.
That's right.
Well, Brian, it's been great talking to you. What are you working on now? What's the next project that you're dealing with?
Well, I finished up another book about Japan and China. Interestingly enough, that second book that I have has completely different themes, and it really doesn't. It's not analogous to Remembering a Patient in terms of its themes, but it does open with another very famous book burning in history, which was the one that was conducted under the reign of the first empire, the first emperor of China, of a unified China, I should say, Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi, who had not only executed scholars around China, but also burned these books that disagreed with the worldview that he wanted to put forth. So it's certainly something I'm excited about. I post a lot of the news and things that I'm doing. I'm going to be talking more about Remembering a Patient in the near future anyway. On rememberingapatient.com, I have all the list of events coming up I'm giving.
And we'll have that link, of course, on our notes page. Well, Brian, thanks again for joining us. It was fascinating talking to you.
Yeah, thanks,
likewise,
Brian.
And best of luck with everything. I like what you guys do.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Take care.
Bye.
Take care.
Well, it was great to have Brian on. It's always a fascinating topic, the whole conflict between reason and fundamentalism. It's a very interesting discussion.
It was good.
Look forward to his future works.
Brian's a cool guy.
He is. He's a cool guy. We have time for science or fiction.
It's time for science. Or fiction.
So each week, I come up with three science news items or fact, two genuine, one fictitious, and I challenge my skeptical rogues to decide which one is the fake. There's no theme this week. Sometimes I have themes. So we have three items. You guys ready to hear them?
Bated breath.
Okay.
I am, at least.
Item number one. Again, two are real, one is fake. Item number one. Toyota has unveiled a prototype green car they claim can achieve 175 miles per gallon. Item number two. Oil drillers have dug up a piece of a dinosaur fossil from 2,615 meters below the ocean floor of the North Sea. And item number three, some astronomers believe that evidence is mounting for the existence of a companion star to our own sun.
Companion star?
Evan, why don't you start us off?
Wow, they all sound wrong. You know, something about that ocean floor doesn't sound right. I don't think we can go down that far below the ocean floor. 2,615 2,615 meters?
That's correct.
Can we go that far down the ocean floor? I wasn't aware that we could go. Maybe we can. The green car sounds plausible. Companion star, that might also be wrong. But I'll stick with number two, because that's what my gut is telling me. I just think that's too deep. I don't think we can go down that far.
Alrighty. Perry?
Yeah, well, it depends what ocean floor you're talking about. If it's 5 feet off the beach, we can do it, you know. It was pretty vague. 175 miles to a gallon, that's, you know, that's impressive. Japanese are good at that sort of thing, however. A sister star to our sun. I'm going to say I'm going to say that the first one is fiction. I think 175 to 1 gallon of gasoline. Is that what you're talking about, a gallon of gasoline?
Yes.
Is a bit much. So I'll say, and it, you know, it's a car, not a model car. Yeah.
It's a car. It's a car.
Okay. So yeah, number one's fiction.
Alrighty. Okay, Rebecca.
Yes. Okay. The hybrid thing seems really, it seems doable. I mean, it's a crazy amount, but, I think that might be true. And, the second one, I'm kind of with Evan on this. That seems really, really deep. I think I'm going to go with that one because I read a news story about the companion star thing too. I think that's true. So I'm going to go with number two.
Okay, we'll see. So far, everyone is buying that the companion star is true. And we have two, Evan and Rebecca think that the fossil under the North Sea is fake, and Perry does not believe that the Japanese have a prototype car for 175 miles per gallon. So, let's see. Well, let's start with number three, since you all agreed that number three is true. Wouldn't you think that you could see the sun? A companion star in our own
system.
Things
can be far away.
But if it's in our own system, how could it be too far away? Even a small star in our own system would be the brightest star in our sky. Unless it were dark. The only possibility is that the companion star is like a brown dwarf or something that does not give off significant light. That one is true.
Uh-huh.
The evidence that has been quote-unquote mounting is the discovery of the alleged 10th planet, right? So Sedna, for example. These are planets, depending on, you know, whether or not you want to define them as such. They are large, you know, larger than Pluto, spherical planetoids surrounding the sun. It's still debatable whether or not they should be actually counted as planets because they're so far out. But they, again, they're like planets and they're bigger than Pluto, that their orbits cannot be really fully accounted for by our current model of the solar system. Now, there's a couple of ways to explain their orbits. One is that it's sometime, you know, billions of years in the past, earlier on in the solar system, we were a lot closer to some of our neighboring stars, and that their gravitational influence put them in the orbits that they're currently in. But there's another school of thought that says, yeah, the orbits can be explained without invoking changes in the past. In fact, if we have a dark companion star to our own sun, that could explain the oddities in the orbits of these newly discovered planets out in the edges of our solar system. So this is still not proved. This is still a working theory. But again, there are those who think that we are moving more in the direction of inferring the existence of this object.
Steve, what's this going to do for my horoscope for the weekend?
You know, that is, as well as, Sedna and Xena, these other bodies are wreaking havoc in the exact science of astrology. Because now you have to account for their influence on all the other planets. It's just mind-boggling.
I'm a little concerned.
It's very concerning. Now, let's see, which one should I go to? So Perry thought that number one was fake, and the other two of you thought that number two was fake. Well, let's go to number two. Oil drillers have dug up a piece of a dinosaur fossil from 2,615 meters below the ocean floor of the North Sea. That one is, in fact, true. That is science. The fact that it's the North Sea, so which means that Perry is right this week. Congratulations, yes. Perry. But we'll get to the green car in a minute. So this is the deepest dinosaur fossil ever found. Paleontologist Jorn Hurum was the first to identify that the bone fragment that was brought up by the drill was actually a fossil, and in fact a dinosaur fossil. This was dug up in 1997, and then a few years later, in 2003, he acquired the fossil, and he was able to identify it recently as the leg bone of a Plateosaurus, a Triassic carnivore. Normally, drills pick up little bits of fossils, mostly seashells and things like that, all the time. This was the largest single fossil fragment ever brought up. During this period of time, about 200 million years ago, the North Sea was a land bridge connecting Greenland and Norway. So this was dry land at the time that this fossil dates from. So a very fortuitous and interesting find, and Hurum gets credit for identifying the species from the tiny fragment, but he says he's very, very confident in the identification. Yes, number one, this one is fiction. So Toyota unveiled a prototype green car they claimed to can achieve 175 miles per hour. Not totally outrageous, but if you have been following along with the hybrid technology, this is about twice what they're getting now.
175 miles per gallon, Steve, you said per
175
hour.
Miles per gallon, thank you. The hybrid technology, which is really interesting, and this is something that we maybe want to talk about in more detail in the future, just all of the facts surrounding both hybrid technology as well as hydrogen fuel cell technology. The hybrid cars that are on the roads now are getting somewhere between 30 and 60 miles per gallon, although the EPA just changed their rules by which cars' miles per gallon get rated to make them more reflective of actual driving conditions as opposed to the absolutely optimal conditions that have been used in the past to get fairly unrealistic miles per gallon numbers. So those numbers are all being downgraded. But even still, the best hybrid cars are getting in the 50s. What is being unveiled and in prototypes and will probably be hitting the streets a year from now is the next step in hybrid technology, which are the plug-in hybrids. So these are hybrids that you can actually plug into any 120-volt outlet and charge it up.
But wasn't that the first stage of electric cars and everything? Didn't we already do that?
If you go back to the 80s and even the 90s when GM and others were working on pure electric cars, those cars had to be charged up. The problem was, and they never became production because our battery technology just is not up to the task of giving pure electric cars the range and power that the average driver would demand. So they never really took off. Hybrids work, of course, you have a gasoline engine, which can give you the range and power, but when you don't need that much power, the electric engine can drive the car. So you get the efficiency of the electric engine, plus there's a lot of other technologies like the regenerative braking that can come into play when you have an electric motor, but you get the range and power component from the gasoline engine. So it really was a very good solution, and it will be the stopgap measure that gets us to probably an eventual hydrogen fuel cell fleet. But now the plug-in is the next step, because now you can plug in the electric batteries in the electric component of the hybrid, something which has not been done so far. The reason why this is a big step forward is because if you are charging a car battery overnight on off-peak electricity, that's the cheapest mile that you'll get. You get, in terms of cents per mile, it's cheaper than gasoline, it's cheaper than running your hybrid otherwise. So that's the most fuel efficient, if you will, thing that we have so far. These cars are expected to get up to about 100 miles per gallon, although I think that that's an optimistic estimate. It's probably be less than that in real driving conditions. So right now, the 100 miles per gallon is the benchmark. There is talk with lighter, with carbon fibers and lighter frames and better, you know, hybrid technology of getting this up to maybe 150 miles per hour, miles per gallon, over the next 10 years or so. 175 is out of the range that's being discussed right now.
Well, just replace miles with kilometers, and we're a lot closer.
That's true. That's true. If I were talking about kilometers per hour, that would have been closer. So, again, not out of control, but that is, you know, it is beyond the projection of any hybrid technology today. So that is all the time we have for this week. Guys, thanks again for joining me. It was fun as always.
Thanks.
Thank you, Doctor.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other podcasts, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.